on Wednesday to answer any questions that you have. Danny, if you're ready to begin the recording, I will go ahead and start recording now. Danny, are you there? I think you're there. Oh, that's funny. Okay. All right, here we go. Here we go. Good morning, everyone. It is Friday, February the 11th, I guess, and this is our office hours session where we'll be talking primarily about the information from week 4 on the internet, but of course, as is always the case during our office hour sessions, we can talk about just about anything that you like during this time, particularly if it's related to our course, but even if it isn't really directly related. Once again, I apologize for not being able to do a live recording on Wednesday night, but I'm glad that we have the technology to do a recording in advance, and I'm sorry you weren't able to ask questions during the talk, but hopefully you've got a lot of questions that have built up and that you're ready to shoot forth this morning. Before we get started with our office hours, just a couple of administrative announcements. Next week, Wednesday of next week, that's the 16th, that's the last lecture. That's week 5 of our 5-week course. So the sort of formal content delivery part of the course will be over next Wednesday. Sometime after Wednesday night, on Thursday or Friday, we will have available a small exam for you to take. Those of you who are taking the course for a grade will have the opportunity to do that exam online, and you'll have several days, a window of about a week probably, in which you can take it before the final deadline. During that period, I will be available online through email, through the forums, and so on. I hadn't planned to schedule a formal kind of, you know, review session or Q&A session, but we can possibly do that if there's strong demand for it. You can email me or Danny or post to the forums if you have any suggestions or ideas about that. Unfortunately, I will be at a conference Friday morning, so I would not be able to do a session like we're doing now on Friday the 18th, I guess. But if there's some other time over the weekend or the following week when we want to have some kind of a structured get-together, we can do that. Alternatively, we can just do it one-on-one through email or having threaded discussions on the forums and so on. So I guess that's it. Oh, also, we'll have a quiz like we usually do this weekend. So hopefully this afternoon or by Saturday at the latest, we'll have one of those little short 5 or 6 question multiple choice quizzes for you to take, again, just to kind of test your knowledge and make sure everything's up to speed. The final exam starting the following week will have short answer, short essay type questions that'll be a little bit more in-depth and require a little bit more kind of analysis and thought on your part. They're more sort of thinking questions as opposed to kind of check your progress questions, which is more the character of the quiz questions, although you do have to think a little bit for those as well. Okay, well, I had a great time thinking about and talking about the internet material from Wednesday, just because it is fun. I like to remember some of the older, the way things were set up in the old days. I mean, the internet is sufficiently new that many of us can remember what the older versions were like, what early web pages were like, and so on. And, you know, sort of the evolution of the internet is something that's very real to many of us. Now, I wasn't around in the 50s and 60s, probably most of you weren't either, but that's one of the neat things about technology markets as opposed to markets for steel or you know, rubber or whatever, that they change so rapidly. So many aspects of them are changing so quickly that we can really see the change right before our eyes. It's like, you know, when you go visit a friend and you, who has children, young children, and you haven't seen the children for a while. You know, you always say, oh my gosh, how they're so big. Your kids have grown so fast. But with your own kids, you don't really notice them getting bigger because you see them every day and it happens so slowly. Most industries are like that. Change is sufficiently gradual that, you know, we're not really aware of it as it's going on around us. But in technology markets, it's more like seeing somebody else's kids that you haven't seen for a long time. Stuff changes really quickly, and we really it's really highly visible to us. Okay, we have some questions that are coming up already in the chat room, so let's in the chat window. So let's go ahead and start. Let's see. Okay, Maggie's asking, what do you think of anonymity in the internet? How does it affect us socially, technologically, if more and more people aren't visibly identifying themselves or taking credit for their actions? And Maggie, that's a really, that's a terrific question. It's a very deep question. It's a little bit beyond my expertise because I am, you know, I'm just a simple economist. I'm not a psychologist or sociologist. So, you know, I can offer some reactions, but please put them in the category of sort of, you know, uninformed speculation or very dilettantish theorizing. I mean, there is a lot of, there's been a lot of writing about this and some hand-wringing about how more generally in today's society, you know, people are not as, they're not connected as deeply as they used to be because they're connected in more, well, not necessarily anonymous ways, although some of it's anonymous, but even when it isn't anonymous, you know, being someone's friend on Facebook is not the same as being their friend in real life. This has been an issue, you know, from the early days of the internet and other kinds of digital communications. The sociologists have a whole theory and literature on what they call social capital. Social capital being, you know, something that's like capital, in the sense that it's kind of a durable asset that individuals possess that is valuable to them, just like a capital, you know, just like a machine or a factory. But social capital is, you know, consists of the relationships or ties or connections that you have to other people. So just as the term capital, the economics term capital, has been broadened to include what they call human capital, meaning skills, knowledge, things that you've learned, right? It's valuable because it allows you to produce more and earn a higher income. It lasts for a long, you know, over some period of time. It's durable. You can invest in human capital by going to school. As you get older, your human capital depreciates, just like a capital asset. You forget things. Your knowledge is not quite as fresh, and so on. So you can see the analogy between economists' conventional notion of capital and the notion of human capital. Likewise, social capital is held to be an asset, a valuable asset that you can invest in by making new friends. It depreciates because your social ties weaken and so on. So there's a lot of literature on you know, what's the value of social capital, which kinds of people have more or less social capital. You know, how can social capital be leveraged or exploited to increase people's earnings or to make them better entrepreneurs or to give them a higher quality of life or whatever. Now, in the social, the reason I'm bringing this up, Maggie, in the social capital literature, they distinguish between different kinds of relationships, what they call strong ties versus weak ties. So, you know, your close friends, your close family members, your immediate colleagues that you work with every day, that you have a close relationship with, you have strong ties with those people, but, you know, casual acquaintances, colleagues you don't know very well, Facebook friends that you don't really know in real space, with them you have what they call weak ties. And the argument is weak ties are not as valuable as social ties, as strong ties in particular situations. And the claim is, over the last few decades, the ratio of strong ties to weak ties in most persons, in the average person's social capital portfolio, has gotten smaller. In other words, we know lots and lots of people on a casual basis, but we know fewer people on a really deep and intimate basis. That's the argument, and there's some evidence that sociologists have provided. I'm not an expert in this area. Well, the most famous account of it is in the book by Robert Putnam. I'll type it in that window here. Robert Putnam, called Bowling Alone. I can't spell Putnam. Bowling Alone. Putnam is a sociologist at Harvard. And his part of his, he had written a famous article about bowling leagues. Those of you who are outside the U.S., you may not know about bowling leagues, but you know bowling, where you roll a ball and you knock over some pins. In the post-war America from the 1950s to the 70s and 80s, a lot of people, men in particular, joined leagues where you would bowl with some friends every night, or once a week, whatever. Wednesday night, you go to the bowling alley and you would have a competition with some teammates. If you've seen The Big Lebowski, right, there's a lot, the dude and Walter and Donnie are in a bowling club, bowling team. So you know, that's what a bowling league is about. And the idea is people made a lot of friends through the bowling league. It was a way of interacting, of socializing with other people in a sort of a fun and deep way. But Putnam had data that, you know, there were no bowling leagues anymore. The number of people participating in bowling leagues had gone way down, and he used that as just one example. There are other kinds of data like, you know, church attendance, participation in community and civic organizations, the Kiwanis Club, whatever, that, you know, attendance in all those organizations had gone down rapidly. And so Putnam's argument was people aren't socializing with people in the community. They aren't socializing with their neighbors anymore. They just kind of keep to themselves, and that's a bad thing. Sometimes you see this point made in terms of architecture. In most of in the West, certainly in the Western world, certainly in the U.S., you know, typical neighborhood built in the 1930s or 1940s, right? The houses have a front porch. There's a sidewalk. And if there's a garage, it's tucked away in the back. And so where the family spends most of its time in the home is at the front of the home. You sit on the front porch and your neighbors walk by and you talk to them, and people get together in the park and they all hang out, you know, on the street or on the sidewalk and visit with each other and so on. Modern subdivisions built in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they don't have front porches or big front porches on average. There's a huge garage, two-car or three-car garage at the front of the house. In fact, in most American subdivisions, houses built in the last 10, 20 years, the dominant feature of the house, when you see it from the front, typical middle-class house, is the garage. And the claim is nowadays people spend most of their time at the back of the house, on the back deck or in the living room or family room in the back. They don't sit on the front porch. There is no front porch. They don't walk around the neighborhood. They don't know their neighbors, right? They don't know the people around them. There's no sense of neighborhood community or neighborhood connection, neighborhood pride. Your neighborhood, that's just a place where your house happens to be. You don't even know who most of your neighbors are. And you know, nowadays you spend your time, you know, on Facebook or you know, Skyping with people all over the world and from your home, or playing video games, you know, with people around the world. You just don't know your real space or meet space neighbors. So one of the claims is that the internet has allowed people to have a lot of shallow relationships, but not very many deep relationships. Now, some of those are anonymous, which goes back to Maggie's original question, right? You know, you can have a pseudonym, you can have a pen name. I've been joking with some with some of my friends on some of my friends in last week that when I signed up for one of those professional networking services, I think it was Plaxo. It wasn't LinkedIn, but it was one of the smaller ones. And, you know, they ask you for your date of birth. And because, like many of you, I'm, you know, cautious about, where I think about identity theft. I don't like to give out my social security number. And I prefer not to give out my real birth date unless I have to, because those are easy ways that people can, you know, to identify real individuals. So I just made up some fake birth date. And then every year on that date, which is like, you know, 4 months different from my actual birthday, I start to get all these warm birthday wishes for people I know on Plaxo, you know, because the little pop-up window came up. It's Peter Klein's birthday. And of course, it isn't my birthday. And that's the point, is these people don't know me well enough to know what my actual birthday is. They only know me in terms of the data that's available on this profile on a social networking site. That's not anonymity. They know my name, but I'm not revealing everything about my true self. One of my kids, one of my teenagers, he plays one of these first-person shooter games that I can't stand. And he has a team and buddies all around the world who are part of his little team in this virtual world. And, you know, we have spent a lot of time talking to our kids about security and safety and privacy over the internet, and insisting that they not reveal their real names, their ages, where they live, the phone number, you know, to people they meet on the internet. And so my son was just telling me that the people on his team, you know, they think he's a college student when he's really 13. And so, what are you going to do if they ask you, where do you go to college? And he revealed that he had a whole script made up. He has a whole alternative persona that he's made up. You know, he's 21 years old. He attends such and such a college. If they ask him what's his major, what classes he's taking, he's got that all planned out. Froze for just a minute. Okay, here we go. Good morning, everyone. Argument made both ways. Some people argue that the internet, in many ways it improves social ties, right? It allows us to connect with long lost friends, and you know, you can have a video chat with grandma who's hundreds of miles away, and blah 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 blah. What's the net effect on society? You know, it's hard to say, but it certainly is interesting to think about how social relations have changed, you know, in kind of important and deep ways. Michael's asking about, can you please elaborate on how the internet of our day is unsuccessful or having trouble to price bandwidth usage, and how to turn to such a system of pricing this scarce resource? You know, the net neutrality crowd seems to be up in arms because of a denial of information on the part of internet service providers. Yeah, it's a great question, something we'll talk about in the net neutrality issue specifically next week. But what Michael is asking is, look, in my lecture, I talked about potential problems associated with congestion, network congestion, or overuse of the internet, of network bandwidth, because there's no metering, because for most users, there's no pricing. You can send, you know, virtually an unlimited amount of data into the stream, so why not? So people, you know, it's overused relative to how much it would be used if individuals had to pay the marginal cost of their use. This argument, there were a lot of technical arguments in the 1990s about how the pricing, you know, how the pricing might actually work and what kind of algorithms could be used at various nodes, you know, by smart routers to figure out how to prioritize packets and so on. Suffice it to say, for our purposes here, assume that it is technically feasible to have some kind of mechanism for metering usage and for billing users according to the amount of data they send out. The economic issue is, look, if you believe that bandwidth is virtually unlimited, such that the marginal cost of an individual, you know, packet of information is zero, then it doesn't make sense to price those packets, right? If you want to charge people according to the marginal cost, how much their activity adds to the total cost of operating the service, and if that marginal cost is zero, well, then the economically efficient price for network usage is zero, right? So this whole argument, the rationale for some kind of pricing scheme assumes that the actual marginal cost is not zero. In other words, that bandwidth really is a scarce resource. Now, the marginal cost for an individual packet may be very, very small, you know, a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a penny. But given that, you know, for high volume users, that, you know, that can add up, and you know, it's a, you know, to meaningful dollar amounts. And as I think I said in the lecture, you know, this is not just idle chat for some kinds of network usage, like wireless telephone usage, right? We talked about how some wireless providers, you know, are in fact metering bandwidth for high volume users. I don't know if any of you, did any of you buy an iPhone from AT&T when they first came out in, what was it, 2007? You know, there were serious, I mean, AT&T's network slowed to a crawl, and there were a lot of real complaints about, you know, people's inability to use the network, because the data transmission speeds were so slow. AT&T's response was, well, we had no idea that the data usage, you know, that iPhone users would use so much data. We grossly underestimated how much, you know, heavier of a strain the iPhone would put on our data networks than the previous handsets that we had been using, right? I mean, just think about it. Think about if you use a whatever kind of smartphone you have, if you use the mobile version of different websites, the data usage is pretty modest, mostly text-based. But you start using real-time, you know, video chat on your iPhone or your Android device, that's using a significantly higher amount of network space than people who are just sending, you know, text messages back and forth. So there really is congestion on most companies' wireless networks. Now, how much, you know, are our backbone fiber optic lines really congested? It's ambiguous. I mean, in some cases it doesn't appear so because the transmission capacity of the highest quality fiber optic lines is so high that, I mean, yeah, the marginal cost of additional use probably is zero or pretty close to zero. But remember, it's not just the fiber optic cable. It's the, you know, it's all of the points from A to B. There are a lot of choke points, switches, routers, web servers, and so on, you know, which really are scarce. I mean, look, here's another example for you geekier types out there. You know, the so-called DOS attack on a website, a denial of service attack. So when a group of hackers, or whatever is the right term, you know, they want to take down a website to punish the provider for something, you know, they basically write programs to have, you know, thousands of you know, browsers or whatever over the world all immediately try to hit a particular website at the same time in a coordinated attack. You can bring it down. And even on a more innocent level, how many times have you gone to a website and it's down? Well, sometimes it's down because they're doing server maintenance or because of some glitch or error, but sometimes it's down because you simply cannot reach the website because too many users are all trying to hit it at the same time. So web server space is scarce, right? So taken as a whole, there certainly is resource scarcity on the internet. The aspects of the internet are scarce resources, and therefore there is a case for some kind of pricing or metering system. Okay? Now, the where, you know, where net neutrality comes in, the net neutrality crowd says, oh, but that's not fair, right? All information has to have equal access, and it's not fair to prioritize certain kinds of content over others. But look, that, you know, that has nothing to do with net neutrality per se. That's just another version of the generic arguments that people make about pricing a scarce resource. Those of you who took, you know, if you've taken an economics, basic economics course, maybe your professor talked about so-called price gouging, right? If a natural disaster, earthquake has struck, or a hurricane is on its way, there are always complaints in the media about merchants who raise their prices. We had a huge blizzard in the Midwest last week. We've had, well, last week, and some parts had a big blizzard this week too. When I went to Home Depot the other day to pick up something, they had run out of snow shovels. They just didn't have any snow shovels left because, in anticipation of the big storm, people had gone to buy extra snow shovels. If Home Depot had responded to this anticipated demand, if as the snowstorm was on the horizon, Home Depot had doubled the price for snow shovels, what would have happened? There would have been angry editorials in the newspaper about how evil and cruel this was, trying to make a buck, you know, in the event of a natural disaster. There would have been legislation in our state or city to punish price gougers, to say it's illegal to raise prices in the event of a disaster, and so on. Well, economists say the whole concept of price gouging doesn't make any sense because, you know, there were only so many snow shovels. There were 100 snow shovels available in the store. If the demand for snow shovels increases, but the seller does not, Home Depot keeps the price low, what's going to happen? Well, the first 100 people who get to the store get a snow shovel. The 101st person doesn't, right? Maybe some of those people who got there early really didn't even need one. Maybe they already had a whole bunch of snow shovels. But they said, oh, hey, more snow's coming. These snow shovels are only $20 a piece. Hey, let's go ahead and pick up a few more while we're here. We don't really need them, but they're cheap, so let's get one or two or ten. And then you have the 101st person who doesn't have even one snow shovel and is desperate for a snow shovel and would pay anything for a snow shovel. He can't get one because they're all gone, right? So using the price mechanism to meter the snow shovels would be a way, you know, would be a better way of trying to get snow shovels in the hands of those who value them the most. But what's going to happen? The politicians, the journalists are going to say, that is so cruel and unfair. That means rich people will get snow shovels and poor people won't. But the point is, you know, you can't legislate away scarcity. If there's only a finite number of snow shovels available, you have to use some procedure for allocating them to specific users. You know, you can't magically make an infinite number of snow shovels appear. So which is more fair? Which is more moral? Which is more just? To give them to the first 100 people who show up, or to give them to those who express a higher valuation for snow shovels in terms of willingness to pay? It's the same thing with net neutrality, right? I mean, the net neutrality crowd thinks that bandwidth is a free good. It's not an economically scarce good. And that the only reason for limiting somebody's use, a content provider or a user, is, you know, cruelty or some nefarious, evil money-making scheme, some kind of price gouging scheme. You know, Comcast would only want to limit, you know, the bandwidth of, you know, some service, other kind of web service, because they're competing with them, and they're trying to drive that. They're trying to drive Google out of business by steering people to Yahoo or something. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, there may be sound business reasons for content providers, hardware services, and so on to form partnerships and write contracts and have coalitions. But even independent of that, there's only so much bandwidth around. And those who own and control network infrastructure, of course, they should exercise some discretion in allowing some information through and some information not through. I mean, tell these journalists who are up in arms about pricing and who are, you know, complaining about net neutrality. I mean, does the New York Times allow any author who writes anything to get their stuff in the New York Times? No, the New York Times has an editorial staff that makes decisions. They discriminate. They let their reporters' stories get on the front page, and they keep, you know, stuff that I write off the front page. Well, that's discrimination. That's not allowing information to be free. That's undemocratic. I mean, you see how silly that would be. But if you take the net neutrality argument seriously, they imply that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post should not be allowed to discriminate among articles, that every article that's submitted should be published. Well, I mean, that's logically impossible because there's only so many pages. And of course, it doesn't make any sense from an editorial point of view either. Excuse me, just one second. I got to write a note. Okay. That was a pretty lengthy way of answering Michael's question. Okay, Michael Roberts has a question. Has there been any thoughts on transaction costs over the internet if the U.S. were to return, were returned to a commodity standard, i.e. gold? I imagine that transaction costs would increase and would slow down, since not only do the goods need to be transferred, but the physical money also. Would it also slow down transactions and exchange in global in the global market? The short answer, Michael, is no. In the following sense, most economists who advocate that kind of monetary reform using a commodity standard like a gold standard, I mean, they're not talking about physically shipping units of gold from place to place, right? The actual commodity, the gold bars or coins or whatever, the seashells, whatever the commodity would be, could still be stored in a secure location, in a safe somewhere. The only thing that would be exchanged is legal titles to specific amounts of gold, right? So having a gold standard doesn't mean that people would necessarily carry gold coins in their pockets to use for transactions, or would ship gold bars, you know, from one place to another for larger transactions. No, there would still be warehouses where the commodities are stored. People would just circulate, you know, in the old days, they would circulate pieces of paper, right? So paper money, you can still have paper money under a gold standard. It's just that what that piece of paper is, and the way Murray Rothbard described it, you know, it's like a warehouse receipt. In other words, it's like you, you know, you take your furniture to a storage place and they give you a little ticket that entitles you to get your furniture back. Well, you could sell your furniture to somebody, but if he lives in the same town as you, you don't have to go get your furniture and put it on a truck and take it to him so he can put it in his warehouse. You can just give him your little piece of paper. So if the little paper tickets are exchangeable, then people can still just trade paper tickets. It's just what they're trading is legal title to actual money. But Mises called it money substitutes. So paper banknotes representing specific units of commodity money, they trade in the market just as if they were money. And of course, if you extend that to the electronic realm, in principle, the way we do electronic commerce now would be exactly the same. It'd be no different. You'd still use PayPal or eBay or you know, your bank or whatever kind of payment mechanism you want. It would just be what the accounting entry represents. When I PayPal you $10, basically I'm giving you legal title to $10 of, you know, gold or seashells or whatever that is physically stored somewhere in a secure location. It's just that now you're the title holder rather than me. You know, exactly how many warehouses would there be? Who would run them? How often would you have to actually transfer things from one warehouse to another? Well, I mean, nobody could say ex ante. We just have to try it out and see. In other words, entrepreneurs would have incentives to figure out transaction cost minimizing ways to engage in commerce when we're using a commodity standard rather than, you know, the a pure fiat standard like we have today. There is some writing. If you look at, if you just do some Googling for, you know, electronic payments under a gold standard, I know that I've seen several articles by people who specialize in monetary economics, you know, trying to speculate on what it might look like. But, you know, again, there is a sort of a general point here about entrepreneurship that, remember, you know, it isn't incumbent on the proponent of market-oriented reform to specify exactly what the new, you know, what the reform would look like. Rothbard used to give the following example. He said, imagine you lived in a society in which the government produced all shoes. So the government had a monopoly on shoe production and distribution. So all of the shoe factories were owned by the state and run by the state and so on. And, you know, then some crazy, wild-eyed libertarian theorist or economist comes along and says, hey, I think we ought to consider privatizing the shoe industry, right? Why not let the free market be responsible for shoes? Well, you'd get two reactions to that, right? One reaction would be, Are you crazy? You know, shoes are extremely important. Everybody needs shoes, and you want to trust that to the free market? No, the government, it's so important the government has to control it. I mean, under your scheme, only rich people would be able to afford shoes. Poor people would go barefoot in the winter. I mean, you know, that, first of all, that helps you realize how silly it is when, if you say, well, what if you privatized XYZ that's currently now run by the state? People say, oh, well, that would never work. We can't leave that to the free market. I remember when, you know, after 9/11 in the U.S., we didn't have a national airport screening service. And people said, oh, well, this just proves that the government needs to take over. We need to form the TSA, Transportation Security Administration. Airport security is far too important to be left to private providers, left to the profit, you know, governed by the profit motive, the evil profit motive. I remember thinking, no, I look at it exactly the opposite way. You know, the more important something is, the less you want to give it to the government, which will inevitably mess it up. But the second reaction you would have is, people say, well, okay, so you, Mr. Economist, Mr. Libertarian, you think the free market can, you know, could operate the shoe industry? Fine. Tell me how it would work. How many shoe factories would there be in the free market? How many different kinds of shoes? What materials would they be made out of? What sizes would they be offered in? What would they look like? What colors? You know, look, who knows? The correct answer would be, well, we don't know. I mean, if there had never been a free market for shoes before, it would be impossible to predict exactly how that market would look. But the point is, we don't have to be able to predict that ex ante, because our theoretical understanding tells us that no, you know, profit-seeking entrepreneurs in the shoe industry will have incentives to experiment with different production methods and different types of shoes and style of shoes, and the market would basically work this out. Entrepreneurs would figure it out, and we would end up with a pretty decent shoe market like what we have in the world today. So the fact that in the question that you raised, the fact that we don't know exactly how electronic payments would work in a free market for money with commodity money, you know, that isn't by itself a good argument against doing it, right? I mean, the market would sort it out, and we can have pretty strong confidence that entrepreneurs would figure out a way that keeps transaction costs as low as they reasonably can be. Okay, Michael, I hope that makes sense. Let's see. Okay, good questions about houses and snow shovels. Good comments and so on. Okay, Ray has a question here. What do you think of the following argument against those who claim that markets will exclude the poor? And by the way, before I answer, note that, you know, I'm happy to transition into questions that aren't directly related to the internet or really even our course. If they're only tangentially related, that's fine. General economics questions or management questions or political questions or any questions that you want to ask. Okay. So what about this argument who claims that markets will harm the poor? In the long run, free competition generally provides incentives to increase productivity, which is eventually reflected in lower prices. I agree. So even if the poor cannot afford something now, they most likely can afford that thing sufficiently late in the future. In particular, one may apply this to network access and other internet goods. I think that's a terrific argument. Right, because if we look at what, you know, capitalist, money-grubbing, you know, free markets typically do, well, over time, of course, are there luxury goods produced in the market? Sure, but that isn't the way entrepreneurs who want to make big money, right? You know, the easiest example to see now is Walmart, right? And I always think it's interesting how many, you know, sort of advocates for the poor are always dumping on Walmart, that, well, Walmart pays low wages, Walmart, you know, discourages its employees from unionizing, you know, Walmart is bad for communities, it drives the mom and pops out of business, and so on. Well, okay, I mean, we can address those arguments one by one. I don't think any of them is particularly strong, But even if those arguments had some validity, what about the consumers of Walmart? I mean, do you guys shop in Walmart? Or those of you who are from outside the US, if you have Aldi or, one of the European or Latin American discounters, Carrefour in your area, I mean, who shops at those places? It's not the liberal elite journalists of the New York Times. It's not the politicians in Washington, D.C. or Brussels or whatever. They don't shop at Walmart. It's the poor, particularly the rural poor, who shop at Walmart. How did Walmart become the world's largest retailer? Well, a number of things. It's first by lowering production costs or lowering the transaction costs of procurement through innovation, through IT. And by the way, as a footnote, we don't normally think of Walmart as a tech company, but it really is. It's one of the most advanced tech companies in the world. The way that Walmart was able to get its costs down, right? I ask my students, why is Walmart so successful? Because they charge low prices. How are they able to charge low prices? Because they're so big, they have such great volume. Well, how did they get to be so big? I mean, Sam Walton started out small, just like everybody else. How did he grow? They don't know, right? And the reason is because Walmart was on the leading edge, the bleeding edge of technology adoption in procurement, right, in supply chain management at the back end. One of the early adopter of barcodes and scanners, computer technology to link the store with the warehouse and so on, right? When you buy a loaf of bread at Walmart, when you scan that barcode at the scanner, that's in real time, immediately sending data back to the warehouse. There's one fewer loaf of bread on the shelf in the store in Columbia, Missouri, and that registers, that contributes to the decision to, when do we send a new truck out to that store with more bread, and we communicate that back to the bakery and so on. Right, I mean, so it's a very tightly integrated supply chain. It's technology innovation that made all that happen. But the second thing about Walmart is Walmart also grew through, sort of a very successful store placement and marketing strategy, namely that Walmart placed its stores in underserved, low-income, rural communities that were not being served by the established retailers and groceries and so on. So you don't see a lot of Walmarts in Manhattan. You don't see a lot of Walmarts in Beverly Hills. You don't see Aldis in the fashionable areas of Paris or whatever. It's the rural, poor, backwards communities. That's where Walmart flourishes. Many of you have seen the movie Winter's Bone, which is a terrific movie. It takes place in Missouri, in southwestern Missouri, and if you watch the movie, get a sense of that community, what it must be like to live there. It's poor, very poor people, dark, it's gray, people with low education and so on. Those are the communities served by Walmart, at least early on. That's where Walmart put its stores. So who are the primary beneficiaries of Walmart? Low-income consumers. Right? So whatever you think of the well-being of Walmart workers, and I happen to think and have some evidence that the arguments that Walmart mistreats its workers are pretty weak. The evidence does not support that at all. But even so, Walmart is a huge, provides huge benefits to consumers through lower prices. So, the raised question is, to what extent does that argument apply to other things besides retail? Well, I think it's a great point from Ray. It applies all over the place. When the internet was in its infancy, who had access to the internet? Well, government researchers, scientists, and university personnel, right? As I think I mentioned, I got my first email account in 1989. I was a PhD student at Berkeley, and I could talk to other, people who are PhD students at large universities. The guy living in a trailer in southwest Missouri did not have an email account. He did not have access to the internet. Even if it were available to him, it would have been very expensive. You couldn't have computer time. You know, look at PCs, look at smartphones, look at how prices have fallen. Right? A personal computer in 1982, only wealthy people could have a personal computer. Only big businesses could afford to have access to a mainframe or whatever. Right now, anybody with $200 can have a decent netbook. Well, not only a decent netbook, a netbook that can compute circles around an expensive PC, in 1982. In fact, early IBM PCs, they're like $4,000 or $5,000 in 1982 dollars. I don't know what that would be in today's dollars, but incredibly expensive. And given that you couldn't do that much with them, only a small number of rich people had them. So, from the manager's point of view, in the business administration literature, if you go to MBA school or whatever, they're always talking about the dangers of commodification. You don't want your product to become a commodity, because then there's a lot of competition and the price is low. You don't make a big profit margin from selling commodities. You want your product to be a unique niche product. An iPhone is something special that people will pay a premium for. An iPad is a novelty item. Now all these new Android tablets and BlackBerry's tablets and there's a Palm HP tablet, that are all coming out. Within a few years, a tablet computer will be more like a commodity, meaning it'll be cheap. And there'll be lots of them competing aggressively with each other. Now, if you're Apple, you don't want that. You don't want your product to become a commodity. But if you're the consumer, you do, because that means it's cheap and plentiful. Okay, so commodification, that's good for the consumer, and that's exactly what competition among entrepreneurs tends to lead to, right? The pursuit of profit by profit-seeking entrepreneurs has the result of driving prices down, lowering production costs, improving the quality of the product, and making us as consumers, of course, better off in the long run. Okay, good. Yeah, there's some great suggestions here in the chat window about some of these online money services. And there's a lot of literature on this, electronic payments, which you can probably find if you look. And the stuff about prices going down and quality's going up. There's lots and lots of data on that. Ray points to there's some charts in the week one reading from the Economic Report of the President, which illustrate this pretty dramatically, and they end in about 2000. If you had the same charts for the next 10 years, you'd see the same pattern even more strongly so, right? I think this some of the discussion we're having now provides a good way to illustrate, this theme. You might be getting a little tired of me sounding like a broken record, saying that the new economy is not completely new, and the old theories still apply. Well, I think this, again, there's some good examples in our discussion today, and I'm trying to hammer home this theme that the sort of general principles about what entrepreneurs do, how the price mechanism allocates a scarce resource. I mean, these are basic ideas you'd get in any. If you read Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, or take any kind of introductory economics course, or read any introductory economics books, even ones that were written, decades ago, 100 years ago, if you read Karl Menger's Principles, published in 1871, and still a very good read, you get most of this, you get a lot of this theory back then. So we're just applying it to these newer technologies, but the basic underlying reasoning is very much the same as what it's always been. And I like Danny made a point earlier in the thread about the ability to watch these Mises Academy lectures on a handheld, on an iPhone, and so on. And it'll be great when that when that technology is refined a little bit more. The fact that even just in the last 5 years, this whole notion of cloud computing and moving things to the cloud it's really placed more of an emphasis on kind of the server end relative to the client end. In other words, if you're like me, right? I mean, so, I've got a desktop PC in my office. I also have a desktop PC at my home office at my house. I also have a laptop. I have an iPad and I have a BlackBerry. Okay, all of those devices can access the web, and there isn't complete transferability or transparency between platforms. I mean, there's some things you can't do on a BlackBerry, but there are a lot of things you can, right? So, for example, I use Dropbox. A lot of you probably use Dropbox or a similar, file storage service. And I've put increasing. I'm using Dropbox more and more for current projects. But there are Dropbox versions for Windows, for BlackBerry OS, for Apple's OS, and I have Dropbox on all five of those devices that I mentioned, and so I can create a document in my office. I can work on it at home from either my laptop or my desktop at home. I can work on it from my iPad. I can work on it from my BlackBerry while I'm waiting to catch a plane. The ability to access information from a variety of locations across a variety of platforms and devices, that's something that we're emphasizing, of course, more and more in technology markets. But it shows another way in which technological advance, benefits the consumer by increasing the utility of these technologies from the point of view of the user. And of course, the costs are low. Most of these services, Dropbox is free for the basic version. Actually, Dropbox is a good illustration of some of the pricing principles that we talked about in week two. So the free Dropbox account, I don't know, what is that, 200, you get 200, I forgot, 200 gigs or 250 gigs or something? No, it must be less than that. But you can buy a deluxe account and get more storage space. And actually, I remember I created some shared project folders in Dropbox for some papers that I'm working on with some co-authors in different places who weren't currently using Dropbox. So when you invite somebody to share your folder, you can also have it invite them to sign up for Dropbox if they haven't already. And so, without meaning to, I got, I don't know, 10 new people to sign up for Dropbox within a short period of time. So I got a prize. I got a bonus of, 50 megs or 50 gigs of additional storage space as a reward for getting other people to sign up. What does, what are we seeing there? A, this notion of giving away the free version and charging for the paid version to increase installed base. Remember, Varian talked about that. And B, a kind of a customer loyalty program. The more you use Dropbox, the more you invite other people to use Dropbox, you get some kind of a bonus or a reward, like it's analogous to, frequent flyer programs. That is also a way of increasing installed base. So Dropbox wants to lock in customers to its platform over some competing platform. Now, the path dependency critics would say, "Oh my gosh, that's awful. We might get stuck using Dropbox when there's really an alternative technology around." Well, that doesn't seem so bad to me right now. I mean, I like getting all this free stuff from Dropbox. I like having access to the program. It works great. And second, maybe a point that I should have made yesterday, I'm sorry, last week, these costs of switching from one standard to another, those are not exogenous. Those are not fixed, given for all time. Those are adjustable. In fact, entrepreneurs, if a new technology is available that's substantially better than the old technology, profit-seeking entrepreneurs have an incentive to come up with ways to get people to switch, for a fee, right? So if I mean, look at word processing programs. In the old days, if you had a document written in Microsoft Word, there's you could you couldn't there's no way you could translate it to Word Perfect format or some whatever format Apple was using. Now it's really easy to convert files back and forth between formats. Why? Because profit-seeking entrepreneurs realize they can make more money by writing software that would convert files from one format to another. So if it turns out that something way better than Dropbox comes out, maybe there's already stuff that's way better than Dropbox, but people aren't switching because they already have accounts on Dropbox, they're loyal to Dropbox, they're locked into Dropbox. If there's other things really that much better, then there's a buck to be made by finding clever ways to get people to switch. So I'm not worried about lock-in in that sense. Matthew, do I have plans for teaching another Mises Academy course in the near future? Well, I have some ideas about courses that I'm interested in doing, but I don't have any definite plans, so nothing has been scheduled. But if you have any courses that you would be particularly interested in having, and things that you think I might be a good fit for teaching, please let me know, or let Danny know. That would help us to decide what kinds of courses it would be good to offer in the future. Michael Orlowski is asking about getting a PhD. Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. My heart tells me, well, of course, because having a PhD in economics or some other field and being a scholar, a teacher, a researcher, that's the greatest life that anyone could possibly have. I want others to share in the joy, but my head tells me that, as you said, we are in a bit of a bubble, and I know that people getting PhDs in many different fields, economics included, are having an increasingly difficult time getting a job. Michael, what I would suggest is, if you can find it on Mises.org, at the Mises University summer program, for the last few years, I have given a lecture. It's really more like a guided discussion section, all about issues for graduate students and people thinking about going to graduate school in econ or another related field. In the last couple of years, we have titled it The Professional Economist, and it's really sort of strategies and tips and tricks for deciding whether to go to grad school, deciding what grad school to go to, how to be successful in grad school, how to get a job when you get out. It's kind of an open forum for students to have a guided discussion about that. And I think a lot of them are, many of them have been recorded. And so you can download the MP3 of last year's or the previous year's version of that professional economist session. And I think that might answer a lot of the questions that you have, Michael, about that. If you can't find the file on Mises.org, just send me an email and I'll happily point you to it. And it's not unrelated at all. It's a good question. And give me a call or send me an email if you want to talk about it one-on-one or talk about your personal situation. Be happy to do that. Okay, a question from Maggie, and this may have to be the last question because I have to provide some child care services in a few minutes. I'm not going to get paid for them, but I will avoid getting punched by my wife, which is a form of payment. Maggie, it seems like Path Dependence sort of ignores the inventor-owner of the supposedly better tech and how they could work to make switching worthwhile. Yeah, I think that's true. A good way to put it is that the Path Dependence folks, again, they assume that the conditions of technology conditions are just kind of, they're out there, they're given, they're fixed, they're unchangeable, or in economist language, they're exogenous, when in fact they come from entrepreneurial action. They're the product of human decision making, of human action, as Mises would say. They are endogenous instead of exogenous, right? So who knows what the switching costs are? Maybe people can find better ways to make the switching costs lower. And you're right. I mean, the people who produce Dvorak or, Apple, when it was producing and marketing the early Apple OS, I mean, those people have the incentives, the ability to try to get people to switch, to make it easier for people to switch, to explain the benefits of switching, to facilitate coordination. I mean, this goes back to the earlier example of, privatizing the shoe industry. I mean, can we predict exactly how profit-seeking entrepreneurs will find ways to reduce switching costs when a new kind of lock-in manifests itself? No, we can't. But what we can say is that given the profit motive in a market setting, there are really strong incentives for doing that. There are big gains to be had from those who can figure out ways to reduce switching costs, to get past lock-in. And of course, on the other side, there are entrepreneurs of the dom producing the dominant incumbent who are trying to figure out ways to get people not to switch by increasing the value of the product that's already the incumbent product. Bottom line, who wins in all of this? We do. The users, the consumers. We're the primary beneficiaries of all this entrepreneurship. So, okay, anyway, well, thanks for providing the link, Maggie, by the way. And thanks to all of you for being here. Like I say, we'll have a quiz ready for you this weekend. And please keep in touch through email and the discussion forums. And we'll have our last lecture of our 5-week series next Wednesday on public policy issues and anything else that seems important but we haven't talked about it up to this point. And I will look forward to seeing all of you guys then. Thanks a lot.